So the first thing we're going to do is just let the speakers, the panelists, introduce themselves and their companies and their position, and then we'll get a little more deeper into what they do and why they're here. So go ahead, Donna. Okay.
So I'm Jim Cady. I run a company called Slacker Radio, and specifically, you know, we all serve audio content to kind of mobile devices, to the home, and to the web. The primary reason we're here is actually later in the week, right, which is on the music side, and that's kind of a big place where we focus, but we also now have begun to expand into spoken word content with ABC News and ESPN, et cetera. So it's a personal radio service specifically for a variety of platforms.
I'm Phil Carney. I'm with a company called Qualcomm. Some of you might have heard of it. Specifically, I'm with Qualcomm Atheros, which is the division that does home networking technologies like Wi-Fi, home plug, Ethernet, all that kind of stuff. I'm here because contention in the networked home is probably one of the big issues that we're trying to help people solve going forward over the next couple years.
My name's Santi Perini. I run product strategy for a company called Totocast, and we're in the business of live video to the home, connected devices, iPhones, Androids, that type of thing. And on the panel, because we're one of the bigger abusers of home network bandwidth with video and trying to make it efficient enough to have a good experience there as part of what we try to strive to do.
All right. Well, I thought that would take about 15 minutes, and it took about three.
Yeah. So. Well, you just said to briefly introduce ourselves.
Okay. Just try and talk a little bit slower so we can stretch this out. So if any of you have, you know, these guys are actually pretty technical, and I told them not to hold back. So if they say something that goes over your head like it has did in the green room on me, you can actually tweet me at 777, and I will ask them, you know, when they take a breath to answer your question or clarify. Or if you just want, if you have a question of, you know, whatever, want to know where I got this stupid shirt or something, then at 777, and I will check those as we go. And then also about halfway through, I'll check and see if anyone has questions that you want to ask at the end, and we'll accommodate those as well. So we have five questions that are supposed to be answered during this panel, but they're actually kind of iterative of each other, so I think we'll just start the conversation with the first one, and just remember to speak slowly. So the first question is, how is cloud-based data currently being delivered into the home, and what are the inherent problems that this creates? So who wants to start it off?
You guys are the cloud delivery guys. You start.
So I'll take the first shot. So just give you kind of a background of what we do and kind of the some of the challenges, I think, and some of the opportunities, I think, moving forward, is we serve audio content primarily. We do it inside the home, but we do it to in a variety of bandwidths, bit rates. So, and we're seeing that more and more customers want, you know, significantly higher quality kind of content coming to them. And so for us, it's not as big of a challenge because our files are very small in comparison to video that one of the other panelists will speak about. But, you know, for us, it's really about serving kind of multiple streams. So in a lot of cases, we've got customers that will have four or five audio streams going in four or five different places in the house. And in many cases, they're obviously compressed, but in a lot of cases, people want that, you know, kind of higher quality audio service moving forward. So it's a little bit contentious. It's not completely contentious in a lot of the ways that we do it virtually. And we give you an understanding of kind of on our side of the fence. So we serve about 50 million songs a day, right? And that so we start in roughly, we start about 1,500 songs a second. So we have a lot of stuff going to a lot of people. And, you know, the interesting thing for us is in the home, it really does seem to be a multiple kind of stream kind of environment.
And I think, you know, when you start talking about streaming into the home and cloud into the home, you have to remember, when I first started in this business, I started at a company called Ascend Technologies in the mid-90s. And the first home router that we made had ISDN 128 kilobit coming in on one side and a single Ethernet port for a single device. Right. Well, if you think about how far we've come in not that long of a time, you know, you're talking about, you know, scores of devices in the home now, right? You know, television, set-top boxes, game controllers, everything, and they all want to do much, much more higher levels of content. And the problem that you face is that the mechanisms for quality of service that have been developed thus far for bringing data into the home are just not sufficient, right? I mean, there's basically, you know, if any of you know anything about quality of service, there's basically four different ways that you can tag the data coming in to say what level of priority you want to give to the router. And as you know, that's fine if you have, you know, maybe one device that's getting all of that data, and it can say, yes, I want this first and this second and this third. But when you start dealing with the problem where you have yourself, your spouse, your children, your friends, you know, those neighbors that you don't know about leeching on your Wi-Fi network, you know, pulling down gosh knows what from BitTorrent, you know, you run into this problem that the mechanisms that are currently available just, you know, don't really handle all the prioritization that you need to do.
I guess I can add the video component to this as well. So you've got all these competing, you know, things from your IP telephone, you've got your video coming in, you've got your audio coming in, you've got gaming going on. The video, the expectations that most people have of that are so high. They don't want the buffering. They don't want a jittery video. They want the highest possible you know, bandwidth, whether that's 480p, 720p, or even full HD at 1020p. So most home networks aren't designed to be able to handle that kind of load along with all of the other pieces that are fighting for that same bandwidth. So, again, I'll do this to a brief kind of introduction of the technology, but a lot of what we deal with is creating multiple streams, not for multiple individuals within the home like we're dealing with in the audio side, but literally for one television, one connected device, having a full 1080p stream, a 720p, a 480p, and it will detect what you have available in the home and send only what you can handle. Now, the downside of that, the good side is you're going to get a stream that's the best possible quality for what your network can handle. The downside is we don't look around the network to see what else you have going on. I think some of the things that the other panelists are going to talk about and some of the systems monitoring that can go into the home will have a big effect on making every experience good so that your gamer in the other room that's playing Xbox Live isn't being hurt by the fact that you're streaming Netflix or a live video or Slacker radio at the same time.
And remember, too, that one of the other big things that people haven't really been talking about that much is the fact that these streams go both ways now, right? Everybody is backing files up to the cloud, you know, grabbing other people's phones, taking inappropriate pictures, and that's going up to some photo stream somewhere, ha, 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 you know, that type of big joke. And really, the networks themselves, if you'll notice, if you have cable or DSL or something like that, it's asymmetrical, right? I mean, they concentrate on giving you the biggest pipe down, but giving you a much smaller pipe going up, right? So there's much more complexity involved there in trying to say, you know, hey, not only do I have to shape bandwidth or reserve bandwidth to bring stuff into your house, now I have to reserve bandwidth to push stuff out of your house as well.
And we are also talking about how that applies conversely to companies where, you know, at home you generally you're consuming a lot, but then within a business you're usually, you know, uploading. It's quite the opposite.
They're more symmetrical in business than in the home for sure.
Is there anything interesting between, because we have radio, music, and then we have video, you know, what are some of the specific difficulties or advantages between the two that you guys could kind of discuss?
Between audio and video?
The video, and then which ones, you know, taking up more of the networks, which ones?
Well, I think the problem is that people want to express quality of service in terms of priority, right? And the problem is that different types of traffic have different requirements beyond just priority, right? So, for example, audio data requires a lot of times much lower latency, right? And so you're not really worried about having a big pipe but you're worried about making sure that, that the packets flow through the pipe and as timely and smoothly as possible. There's this thing called jitter, and you want to reduce jitter on that connection to make sure that, you know, there's no stuttering or restarting of the audio. Video is a whole different bird of a different color.
Yeah, we have to deal with buffering, so you don't want to be halfway through a live stream and then see that wheel of death spinning on your television, nor do you want the jitter and the bad effect. And we deal with the audio effects as well, so the audio stream has to be very consistent, even if we talked about the adaptive bit rate, where we'll drop to a lower resolution based on what your home can handle, but that audio has to be consistent, because the experience of having video drop is one thing, but if the audio changes, it's unacceptable. So we tend to do things like make sure that every link in the chain encodes properly for the best possible experience, and that goes all the way back to the source. One critical component for live video is that you have dedicated bandwidth at the source of a place of origin. So this week we're streaming all week with the John Lennon educational tour bus, and there's going to be a lot of bands stopping by. Kevin Smith did an interview today, all stream live. We've got a satellite unit there on site that's part of the bus that streams that first mile, because if you don't get a good, solid, reliable, high bandwidth dedicated stream from the source, you can't ever expect to have that consistent, you know, high experience in the home or on your iPhone or Android. So our message is all the way through the chain, from beginning to end. It has to be, you know, worried about bandwidth and making sure we're pushing as much as possible without contention. Yeah,
yeah, and that is especially true with live or near live audio and video content as opposed to pre-recorded content, right? With pre-recorded content, you can get that little thing which says buffering, but people, you know, when you're watching a live event or you're listening to a live event, people from a user experience standpoint don't want to put up with that, right? And so a lot of people have taken a lot of time and effort and a lot of very complex mathematics to try and help solve that problem.
Thank you for eloquently answering my poorly worded question. So the second question is actually a little bit more of a history lesson, but we'll try and keep it brief. What about the technology landscape has changed that requires current and future digital technologies to demand an ultra-responsive network connection?
Nobody wants to say anything? Okay.
any super tech?
I think, you know, we talked a lot about the various different types of data that are flowing through. It's not just what we would normally call bulk data, right, where you're just shoving it through, la-di-da, you know, go down through the router and hand it out as best effort. The biggest problem that you run into now is that it has become harder and harder and harder to sort of identify what the needs are of these various streams at various points in the network, whether it be fully upstream or fully downstream. The other big problem is that nobody who makes devices, you know, whether they be your MacBook Pro or your iPad or your Dell notebook, can decide on formats that everybody agrees upon, especially for things like video. So you end up having to do, you know, from a technology standpoint, you have to do this what's called transcoding to put it into the proper format for that device. Now, you can either do that upstream or you can do that at the device itself. But if you do that at the device itself, you know, it takes forever to transcode. So, having to transcode data, having to deal with a lot of different types of data, and having to deal with a lot of different people in the house are the three big things that I think that have changed most recently, along with what I said before, data's going back up into the cloud, and that's only going to get to be more and more and more as we go forward.
With Skype and two-way communication and everything else.
Yeah, it's not even that. Everything wants to back everything up, right? I have backups of backups of backups of backups. I don't even know where they all go or anymore.
So one of the things we do, right, specifically just in a production environment, so we do exactly that, right? So we have, you know, any number of devices. At last count, I think there's 198 devices that kind of connect with our service, and they all take a little bit different stream in a lot of cases, in a little bit different format. So rather than store 198 different formats of a library that has, you know, probably 100 million pieces of data, we store the most common, you know, half a dozen formats, and then we transcode everything on the fly, right? So we have, you know, in that case, a big batch of servers that sit there in front that say, hey, this device is just connected. Everything that it asks has to be then transcoded and converted into another file type that's most appropriate for that specific device. So it requires, fortunately, you know, today processing power is relatively inexpensive, so the ability to be able to do that in real time is something that wasn't probably available in a cost-effective fashion 5 years ago, but is today in that regard. So that way we don't have to have, you know, we have 300 petabytes of music content in our system, and you can imagine if we had to multiply that by all the different types of formats that are appropriate without being able to do that live transcoding on the fly.
Yeah. Hey, do you think they could turn the heat up in here?
Why is it?
Because it's hotter than the sun in here. It's unbelievable.
Is it? Because this room's so full?
Yeah.
Welcome to Texas. Yeah. Just to elaborate a little bit on what Jim was saying, too, video, we have the same issue. You have to transcode what we call transcode on the edge, which means you have a lot of equipment on site with that video truck and with that satellite truck, creating all these different formats and different bit rates and different encoding rates. The trend that we're seeing, though, is being able to push that transcoding up into the cloud more so that you're sending a single stream up over the satellite network, and then it drops down for transcoding in a cloud-based network. The one downside, especially with our business being primarily live, is the latency that you can get. We don't want to be any more than 10 seconds after the actual event, because there's a lot of social media now that's driving live to actually be live. So if there's a question for a moderator, you want that question to get to them in a timely fashion. If it's 40 seconds or even, you know, 2 minutes later, there's an issue. So we're toying with and are playing with different technologies that allow that to happen now, but the trend is more for transcoding in the cloud in the future, because it takes a lot of hardware to do this on site and a lot of bandwidth, and both are very expensive. So,
speaking of timely questions for moderators, I actually got one like 12 minutes ago.
Okay.
And probably should have answered it early on. So I'm not going to, like...
Where did you buy that shirt, by the way?
It's from Asia, actually.
Shocking.
But I don't want to, you know... So the I'm not going to name like your name or your Twitter handle, cuz like I don't want to blow up your spot, but if you do, if you want to like have it associated with your name and come and introduce yourself, then we'll have the Q&A at the end. So basically the question is, you know, specifically, what does contention of a home network mean? You know, kind of define that.
So contention specifically means a lack of fairness. Okay, what contention means is that the pipe is only so large, and you're trying to force all these things through the pipe, and not everything can come through the pipe when you want it to. So there are two or more things contending for a portion or the entire pipe coming into your house, such that somebody gets what they want and somebody doesn't get what they want, right? And that manifests itself in the form of videos that glitch, music that glitches, rebuffering. You'll see all of a sudden web pages may stop loading. There are some applications, YouTube, that I won't name, which will actually take up to 70% of the pipe in your house, all right, which is completely and utterly not fair, right? So while, you know, you may be sitting there trying to watch some sort of streaming video from, you know, Netflix or Hulu or Vudu or anybody else, you know, your kid can come in and fire up the latest Lady Gaga video or something like that on another service and completely destroy your connection. Now, what happens? The problem with that? What's the problem? Well, the problem is, who gets blamed for that? Do the guys that caused the contention problem get blamed for that? Usually not. What ends up happening is the people who are the victim of the contention problem get blamed for it, and they end up calling or sending email or tweeting or whatever, yelling and screaming at you, when it's really not your fault because you're trying to be a good network citizen and they're not. But basically, contention comes down to two people want the same thing and they can't get it when they want to get it.
Okay, so on to the third question, which is, what are the key components needed to make cloud-based media streaming mainstream within the home?
Do you want to?
So, okay, number one, you need to solve the contention problem, right? And how you solve that contention problem, there are a number of technologies that networking companies like ours are working on to solve this. And one of the ways that they're solving this is a thing called stream analysis and stream detection. What happens now that these guys will tell you that they make an app that runs on your computer or runs on your phone, right? Well, the problem is that the app that runs on your computer or runs on your phone has no way to tell that $39 little router that you bought, you know, hey, I need this much bandwidth, I need this much latency, I need this much throughput, right? What stream analysis does is it allows the router itself to sit there and notice the kind of traffic that you're pushing through it, right? Oh, you're gaming, you're doing video, you're doing audio, you're uploading something to Dropbox, right? And it can do one of two things. It can actually make automatic decisions as to which is more important, or more importantly, what a lot of these systems that you'll see within the next couple years are doing, they're allowing you as the user to decide, to pop up and say, you know, hey, I want to prioritize watching a movie on my television over somebody playing Warcraft or something else in the next room.
I mean, I think that one thing that we see, right, and we deal with every major wireless carrier, and I'll give you an example. Take it out of the home for a second and move it into a personal space on the wireless side, right? Because all of you have that right in your pocket, right? So you'll have a phone in your pocket, and the fact is that most of your, you know, I would guess everybody in this room has email on their phone, has text on their phone, has voice on their phone, has, you know, other a web browser on their phone, right? And you know that at the end of the day, and you can think about this in that analogy, right, is that the one thing you want to do, at least in most cases, right, is when a phone call comes in, you want to be able to handle that, right? That is the priority from your perspective. And then, so as a result, the networks have made and the device manufacturers have made that decision for you, right? That gets a little bit more complex in the home, right, because of the fact that you've got a pipe and you've got a number of people that are kind of sharing that pipe versus you're simply dealing with that pipe in your pocket, right? But you're willing to make that, allow them to be able to make that decision for you. But now you've got to make that decision between what's happening upstairs and what's happening in the basement, mm-hmm. and whether the phone rings because your IP phone and somebody else is watching a movie and somebody else is playing games, and you've got, you know, multiple people all sharing that pipe. So there's got to be some level of intelligence that's applied to that in order to be able to make those decisions.
And those, you know, that level of intelligence needs to be not only on the single point of failure in your home network now, your home router, but also on all the devices in your home. One of the emerging technologies that if any of you ever want to fall asleep, you can read IEEE 1905. IEEE 1905 is a specification for what's called hybrid networking. Now, if you think about your home network today, there's only one way for one path for data to come in and out of your home network, right? It comes in through your cable or DSL modem and then more than likely goes out over Wi-Fi, right? It's a single point of failure. If I were to come into your house with a hammer and smash your home router, you're done, right? Unless you can go get to your phone before I smash your phone too, right? You're done. You're dead in the water. You're not doing anything, right? And the problem is there's only one ingress and one egress. What hybrid networking allows is a bunch of common networking technologies beyond just Wi-Fi. There's HomePlug, which is power line networking.
Right.
There's MoCA, which is over cable. And what the 1905 standard says is it puts together a whole bunch of software layers up above, which allow you to decide, and devices to decide, right, which one of these paths they're going to take. So perhaps, let's say your television contains power line networking and it contains Wi-Fi. If there starts to become contention over the Wi-Fi network, the television could just say, look, Mr. Router, I'm going to go over to Powerline. And the router says, fantastic. Right? As a matter of fact, the way a lot of this hybrid networking technology that you're seeing, some of it you saw at CES. I don't know if you were running around looking at the really geeky networking stuff at CES. You saw some of it at CES where the failover is instant. As soon as there starts to be degradation of one link, traffic is automatically routed over another link. If you think about it, it's a lot like the way if you work in a Fortune 500 company, things work in a Fortune 500 company, right? There's no single point of failure in the data network in your office, right? You can go into a phone closet and smash a few things and magically things reroute automatically and they continue to work. You're going to see a lot more hybrid technology coming into the homes over the next couple of years to help solve this problem, not just in the area of audiovisual, but also in the area of the Internet of Everything and home control and stuff like that.
I'm going to add something real briefly, too. It's great that there's so many technologies coming into the home to help solve some of these contention issues, but I think the point you bring up about YouTube kind of being a bandwidth hog. It's kind of on all of us to develop applications as well to be good citizens and to create the highest, best possible experience with the lowest bandwidth requirements. And there are ways of understanding the device you're going down to and being able to create those versions of whatever your audio stream and your video stream is. And I think consumer demand is going to force that as well, because right now you don't know why you're getting that spinning wheel on Netflix, but as people become more aware and there's more sessions like this, it's going to put the impetus back on the people creating those applications to be much better citizens about the bandwidth usage.
Right, and I think you know one of the things that everybody can do, and you can yell and tweet and just tell everybody, is don't settle for the $49 router. Okay, all of these new technologies are not going to be in the $49 router. Okay, they're going to be in the $99 or $129 or even $199 router. Right? I mean, all this type of intelligence doesn't come for free. And you know what you need is, you know, if you're getting your router from your service provider, you need to tell your service provider, hey, you know, I don't just want the bare minimum. I do a lot of interesting stuff in my house. Therefore, I need real, contention mitigation technology in my home. One thing I thought about briefly too is one of the other problems that you probably have that you don't even realize that you have is your Wi-Fi. Your Wi-Fi doesn't cover your whole house. And using technologies like these other hybrid technologies, you'll be able to take things like have like little range extenders where it has power line networking on one side and Wi-Fi on the other. And if you have a room where you have bad Wi-Fi coverage, you can just go boop and plug it right into the wall, and magically you go from one bar to four bars of signal.
But the Wi-Fi creates another problem in that it's not always the highest bandwidth way to use. So you're talking about things like home plugs where you can actually get an Ethernet connection wherever you need it within the home, as opposed to getting there with Wi-Fi. And we find with the video, especially people that are using Apple TV, Roku boxes, Boxy boxes to create a IP set top. The Wi-Fi option is very easy to set up, but it oftentimes isn't enough to create a good viewing experience.
Yeah, and to that end, I don't know if any of you were at CES, they announced the HomePlug AV2 specification, which is the highest bandwidth over power lines, and it works over coax cable. So it does 500 megabits over the power lines in your house and up to 700 megabits over coax cable, right? So, I mean, we are working hard to develop technologies to give you the best amount of bandwidth in your home that you can have.
I you just touched upon a few of things that actionable things that people could do to improve, reduce contention. Can you expand on, are there any other specific things, like if somebody's trying to set up, they have kids, or you're talking about how, there's someone's trying to watch YouTube, someone's streaming music, someone's playing Call of Duty and all over the house, what could you do to really optimize that home experience?
Well, I think, like I said, your choice of equipment is number one. You'll start to see this year people talk about things like stream engine technology and stuff in their equipment. Make sure you go out and you get that equipment, and I guarantee you'll amaze your friends, right? You'll go watch this. If you're a parent, one of the other interesting things you can do with this technology is you can actually, because it can identify different types of streams, you can also limit those types of streams not by bandwidth, but also by time of day, length of time, things like that. So if you only want your kids to be playing Warcraft from, it's 5 p.m. to 8 p.m. Monday through Friday, you'll be able to do things like that. Don't be shy. I mean, this is the age of crowdsourcing and social media. Don't be shy about telling manufacturers, hey, I want a better experience with this kind of stuff, right? I need a better experience with this kind of stuff. And yell at people like me and say, dude, it's too hard to set this stuff up. Make it easier to set this stuff up.
Okay. Are you guys familiar with any of the gaming services such as OnLive? I was actually, it's kind of rough. Like, pretty much if you play World of Warcraft or Call of Duty, like, you end up with lag on the Xbox 360 or the PC, the PlayStation, doesn't matter. Even games that just came out like Mass Effect or Street Fighter Cross Tekken, doesn't matter if you're still going to get that lag somehow, somewhere. But OnLive actually has this, almost unparalleled technology where you can play your own game and then you can immediately hop into this hub and see, you know, dozens and dozens of other, you know, basically thumbnails of on live games streaming right now. And you can view all of them at once, streaming live. You can pick any single one to jump in and see what someone else is playing. You can interact with them. You can chat with them. And I was kind of, you know, it would have been nice to have, like, someone from OnLive here.
You should have told me. Dick Zillman, the VP of Engineering, is a buddy of mine from Apple. I could have gotten him.
Can you tweet him right now and ask him some questions? So basically, how were they able to do that when, you know, the Xbox, so many of the other gaming experiences are behind? Because on the question, basically, OnLive is so far ahead of what you get on, like, a home console experience, or even, you know, through Steam or EA or Origin, stuff like that. How was OnLive and similar services to that, live streaming gaming services, how were they able to just leapfrog, you know, the mainstream technology that we're using?
Well, not as familiar with the direct technology, but we just did an event with Sony PlayStation for the Twisted Metal Live or Twisted Metal 3 launch, and part of this, and again, it's a little bit of a diversion, but I'll get back to your question a little more directly. But the whole concept was there were two machine guns, live machine guns, set up in the desert with four cameras total, and you tweeted to get in line to shoot these cameras live. And there was an application that was created that would aim the machine gun. You had 30 seconds worth of ammo in order to fire, and you were able to basically destroy these elements from the game. So Sweet Tooth's ice cream truck, for example, was there, and it was loaded with C4. Sounds a little sadistic, but from a technology standpoint, the whole concept was, how do we reduce latency? Because live, in that case, is under a second. You can't have any kind of drag or lag, because you're literally aiming a device, pushing a play button or a shoot button. And we had to do a lot in the whole chain. So the satellite latency had to be minimized by reducing buffers. We had to minimize any kind of content distribution network. So we used Akamai as the network to push this out to the hundreds of thousands of people that were involved in the game. Well, that latency was different than the people that were actually playing and were live on it. So my assumption is OnLive has done a very good job of understanding the entire chain of events that has to happen between there, and is minimizing the drag, the latency, the jitter through that, where Xbox Live, for example, was kind of an afterthought. They added voice over IP. They added the live gaming. It wasn't really integrated into that platform as a first round. And so I think you always have an advantage when you can watch how someone else has done it and then eliminate the processes in between. That's what we were doing with the Twisted Metal example, you know.
Okay. Any other additions?
No, I think he's absolutely right. Right, what the OnLive guys did is they went from the ground up trying to design a latency minimum protocol that they use to get back to their servers. Whereas a lot of these other game services, let's be honest, a lot of these other companies designing these games just go and take whatever multiplayer gaming engine from whatever company and just take it vanilla and drop it in, because they have absolutely nobody on their programming staff that understands anything about networking, right? Whereas the OnLive guys took the exact opposite approach. They're like, we know about networking, but we don't know as much about gaming, so let's go figure out the networking side of things and let the game developers do the game part.
Yeah, and they just announced that, like, Lord of the Rings, the MMO, which is, you know, it's on, from a technical standpoint, it's on par with World of Warcraft or whatever. It's that scope that you can now stream it live in your web browser. So I guess, like, the, as you said, you know, the technology, our bandwidth, even as limited as it is, like, when developed specifically for it and smartly.
Purposeful.
You know? Right. Then you can kind of overcome a lot of the things that we're still struggling with.
Yeah, and it's awesome. If you actually look at the data that's going over there, it's much, much less data going over there. There's not any graphics primitives or anything like that flying over the network. It's actually highly optimized mathematical algorithms for what's going on the screen. So it's really interesting way that they've done things.
All right. I got my quota of video game stuff out of the way. So can you, just to put it in perspective a little bit more, can you describe the streaming process? Like you were talking about your streaming, you were doing a Kevin Smith thing an hour ago. your company. Can you kind of talk about what is entailed, you know, in that process?
Sure. From top to bottom, it all starts with production, and there's no substitute in technology for good production, good camera work, good direction. I can't emphasize enough that the best things we've ever streamed started with just a really quality, you know, content that people cared about, and then to put that content in perspective with a real, you know, artful director and producer. From there, we take HD camera feeds into some sort of on-site switching device. So in live, it's all about you've got four or five cameras set up. Maybe you've got, you know, some backstage, you know, action going on if it happens to be at an entertainment event. And there's these devices that have come out, one by NewTek called the TriCaster. This is a fantastic device because it can take four or five camera streams and let you live switch, just like you're sitting in a production truck in an NFL game, but it's much more cost effective. And so this is the first step. Which camera is going to go live to the stream? Second step is, now that I've got a stream defined and there's multiple cameras coming about, what formats do we need to encode this in before we send it out over the satellite? So today we have to encode in a lot of different formats. We typically will create a 720p level quality stream, which goes out at about 1.7 meg, an 800k, a 400k, and so on and so forth, until we get down to 200k, which is what most people can watch on 3G phone devices. So we send all that up over satellite, and then it drops into a hub that's able to take these streams and send it to a content distribution network. And it sounds like a lot of steps and a lot of cumbersome components, because it is. I mean, it's very, very not evolved technology. Video is the new frontier so far, and live streaming of audio absolutely in the same boat. So once we get this thing into Akamai, now we have a distribution network that was capable of streaming the royal wedding and Obama's inauguration. 9 million people at once can see this little stream coming from the John Lennon bus in a parking lot on South Congress as a result of that technology. The downside is Akamai and other CDNs don't know how to encode and transcode for all these different device types. So we still have to worry about, well, you know, Steve Jobs' famous battle with Flash and the lack of encoding for Flash on a iPhone. So we're having to take not only those qualities of streams, but create different versions of them, an HLS, an RTMP, for example. So now that we've got all that straight, we actually get to the device type, and there has to be a player receiving these streams that's smart enough to say, well, I'm looking at my available bandwidth, I'm looking at my frame rates that I can handle, I'm going to take that 400K stream, and if everything goes well with that, I may try to bump up to the 800K or all the way to the 720P stream, but all of this processing now is happening on your phone and on your web browser or on your Roku box or Apple TV. So at each one of those steps, if anything isn't done in the most optimal way, with the most efficiency in mind, with the final screen format in mind, your experience isn't going to be what it could be. And so we're hopeful that, you know, some of the technologies Phil has talked about in the home, technologies like transcoding in the cloud, will allow us to do more what we're good at, which is really creating quality content and events and executive producing, so that we're not in every step of the technology chain. But that's what it takes today to bring live video to your phone. It seems like it should be pretty easy, but it's challenging.
You know? And I'll tell you one. For those of you that don't know, from right after 9/11 till 2009, I was the director of engineering for communications technologies at Apple. And to give you an idea how good hybrid and Powerline and stuff is, Steve Jobs even used Powerline and hybrid stuff in his house. He just didn't know it. I got a call one day from Steve's assistant. He was at home screaming and yelling that this new iMac that they put in the back of his house for his wife wasn't working. The Wi-Fi didn't work, and it was the end of the world because his wife's Wi-Fi didn't work. And I, myself and another guy went over to the house, and sure enough, Steve's house is all plaster walls with, you know, metal all through the walls. So, you know, wireless doesn't like to go through metal. You'd never know that from the way Macs are built. But so what we ended up doing is I ended up grabbing two Powerline adapters, plugged one into the back of his router, snuck one back into the room, plugged it into the wall, sort of hid it so that he and his wife couldn't see it, and then plugged an Ethernet cable in. And magically, you know, the iMac was back on the network, and he was happy, and he was just none the wiser. He actually had Powerline in his house for many years and didn't even know it. So, you know, it's a testimonial that even Steve used it.
So give you a little bit of a you know, ours is a little bit different than the way that you approach it. So from an audio standpoint, so we do live streaming, but we also do obviously individual streams, personalized streams for a number of individuals. So anytime we, like I mentioned earlier, we can generally start anywhere between 1,000 and 1,500 streams a second, right? So with everybody having a distinct stream, so how we deal with it is a little bit different. So we have a main storage base that then gets fed out into about 25 or 30,000 servers throughout the country. And those servers check in every night to find out, as an example, what the most common listened to content is. And if that content is available at that point when a customer or a client requests it, right, it'll be served by wherever server is closest to you. If it's not, then it comes back to Origin, and then it comes directly from Origin. So we mix the content that comes from a local server to a content that comes from San Diego, right? So, and we serve all of North America from one facility in San Diego with regards to that. And we do that on an ongoing, you know, and kind of real-time basis. The nice part about it is the way that we've got the network structure in place, that there's really very little latency. So you would never know, right, if it came from your local server. You may notice just a couple of hundred milliseconds if it had to come all the way from San Diego. We actually serve content as well in the same fashion from San Diego to London, right? So the customer in London doesn't know that the track that they just requested, the music track that they just requested, is being served from San Diego in that fashion. But what we do on the client, and we do all of that, it's all decision. All those decisions are made on the server side. None of them are made on the client side. We don't allow the client really to make any of those decisions. The server will pulse the client continuously to find out what does its bandwidth look like, what is it, you know, what are all the specifics of that specific client that we can accept, whether it's, you know, bandwidth or whether it's whatever, right? You know, contentions in the network. And then we will serve content based upon that. The server will also tell the client, and if they've got, as an example, on a wireless side, right? So if they have a lot of bandwidth at the moment, the client will then begin to suck down a lot of content ahead of time, right? So it gets, it takes advantage of that, bandwidth, so it then can then buffer ahead if it wishes, right? Some of that content gets thrown away, some of it doesn't, based upon what the next user request is. So there's a lot of sophistication. We keep it in our approach on the server side, not on the client side, just because it's easier for us to adjust on the fly based upon that. And that includes, you know, fidelity level, so you can see the fidelity level go up and down based upon bandwidth. But all of that, again, is done on the on our side of the fence, not on the client side of the fence.
All right, so apparently my phone is on a contentious network, otherwise known as AT&T, because I keep getting these tweets a little late. But I do have some questions for you guys. So the first one is, are there protocols to negotiate QoS requirements with the internet provider?
With the internet provider?
With the internet provider.
No.
Okay.
Would you like to elaborate?
So then the next one is, as a media company putting our content onto all these new platforms such as Roku, Apple TV, Xbox, etc., and words of any words of autocorrect, any words of caution or advice to ensure we help give the best user experience so they don't blame us, the content provider?
Maybe I'll start with that one. Right now, as you've probably already found, that there are no standards amongst these units. So the Roku uses a similar format to, believe it or not, to an iPhone. It's HLS. Has to be, you know, chunked up properly. They do have some multi-bit rate capabilities, but there's no error detection. There's a lot of nuances with every one of those platforms that you need to learn and understand and do your best on one and replicate to the others for the time being. So, for example, we launched Roku in January, and we're already on a third round of, you know, changes to it so that we can detect errors in the process and do more proactively more multi-bit rate adaptation. So, for example, the Roku box isn't very intelligent by itself. The whole point of it was to create a very small footprint and do most of the processing before you ever get there. The Xbox, on the other hand, has a lot of processing available, and so there's more things that can be done from a media streaming standpoint there, but I hate to say it right now, just like if you've developed an app for an Android and an iPhone, you know, they're very, very different application development environments. The same is true for all these IPTV formats like Samsung and LG. It's true for Xbox. It's true for Roku and so on. And there really are no good bridge technologies today where you can write to an abstraction layer and then have that create the app versions. It is a lot of heavy lifting right now, but I think those that are early to the game and that are creating this domain expertise are going to benefit very much so as Google TV really launches more predominantly in the summer, and we'll start to see one or more of these formats to take hold. And if you've done your homework on each of these different platforms and kind of understand those nuances, you'd be in a position to take advantage of those, you know, strengths and weaknesses from each of the platforms. I wish it was an easier answer to just say do this and everything works out, but you really do have to learn each platform, just like you had to when you're developing mobile apps or developing for different browser types. IE6 couldn't do some of the things that Firefox could, and you had to make a decision whether you wanted that functionality to carry forward or you just weren't going to support certain browser types. The same is true on, I think, connected TVs in the home.
Okay. The next one is...
So let me add to that. So okay. One other thing that I think that for those of you that want to do that, right, there's a variety of things. And the one thing is, you know, one thing that I would add to that is that it's continuously changing, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it changes, you know, in some cases on a daily basis, right, in terms of how the networks process some of the, you know, some of the downshift, as I would refer to them as downshifts and upshifts, in terms of, you know, are they going to give you more bandwidth, are they going to give you less, right, especially on the wireless side where, you know, they will shift that continuously, right? So as they roll out, you know, new towers or new technology, right, and they're trying to deal with this bandwidth, you know, demand as well, right? So it's an ongoing battle where something may work today and not work as well, you know, this you know, tonight because of the fact that they've made network changes, right? And we see it specifically because we actually now have our network engineering crew has a double shift that works over the weekend because the wireless networks generally will make those changes on the weekend, right? So all of a sudden we'll get a variety of issues that come in from consumers, you know, on Saturday because they made a change at midnight on Friday night, right? When they think the traffic is a little bit lower, right? And then all of a sudden, you know, we go through a whole bunch of gyrations and a whole bunch of changes have to be made. So it's something that will be, I think, a continuous kind of issue as everybody tries to cope with, you know, the demand for more and more bandwidth and smarter bandwidth in that regard.
And, you know, I think these guys both said something that if you're going to get into that business that you should take to heart. They both said things about network engineering, right? You know, one of the things you can do is hire some networking guys that understand this type of stuff. Us networking guys are a very small community. We pretty much all know each other through various standards bodies and things like that. So, you know, hiring people with that type of expertise, hiring people with that expertise who want to participate in things like these standards bodies to go advance, you know, the next generation of these technologies is really, really, really important. It's much more important than I think people give credit for, right? Because, I don't know all of the nuances of delivering video, right? I don't know all the nuances in delivering audio. But for me, we have a saying, bits is bits, right? I take a bit, I tweak a bit, I push a bit. As a networking guy, that's what I do. And I can help you do that better, and folks like myself can help you do that better in such a way that, you know, various devices from a bunch of different manufacturers all know the same types of standards and are all working together.
They liked your answer. So roughly 21 minutes ago, you were talking about good citizens, and I have a question about that. We can't rely on the software to be good citizens. How can we design hardware/software around bad citizens?
So I should say that there's a little bit of a doom and gloom type of picture painted here, but it's not really. As you look forward this year and next year, you're going to hear a new term coming out of the networking industry called smart routers. And what smart routers are going to be the same type of malleable computing platforms that can take extra added software, right? Just like, you know, 6 or 7 years ago, your phone couldn't take extra added software. Now, you know, we've downloaded billions and billions and billions of apps. So one of the things that we're looking from the lower networking point of view is being able to take a portion of these guys' application, right, and host it right on the router, right, so that every device inside the house has access to their algorithms and what they're doing, rather than they, like he just said, I have to do this version for Roku and this version for this TV and this version for that TV and this version for another TV. With these emerging smart router technologies, what you'll be able to do is to build your engine for either pushing or consuming media or whatever you want to do and put it right on the router or a thing that's called a smart services hub. You've probably only seen this in the context right now of like health applications. They have these things where you can, it's this magic little box, it plugs into the wall and it's got Wi-Fi in it and it connects to your router, and what it does is it can deal with glucose meters and blood pressure monitors and stuff like that. Well, what's happening is those are pretty relatively dumb devices. They don't really know much about other than what they do, but what they rely on is a smart hub which has a bunch of different applications running inside of it that they talk to, which then talks back to the cloud, right? So it's basically a disaggregation of these applications, right? One step was putting the application on these end devices like smartphones and tablets and things like that. The next step that you're going to see is pieces of these applications run in that common point, which gives you access to the network.
Okay, so we only have a few minutes left. I don't want to like volunteer these guys, but I would imagine that if you have any questions that didn't get answered, you might be able to find their home addresses on Google. And
I'm happy to answer questions. Just buy me a beer or something like that. You know, or just find me a place where they're serving free beer. I hear they serve free beer here somewhere in Austin this week. So
I got a cupcake for free, and that's about as much swag as I've had this entire trip. So I actually wanted to ask about international. In Japan and some of Europe, they just have far fewer restrictions on their bandwidth. It's through the roof compared to what we have, what Comcast and AT&T and everyone kind of does. Why is that, and when can we kind of get closer to those numbers?
You guys are all looking at me.
I'll take the first stab at it, right? So, I mean, you know, interesting thing is for those of you that travel, you'll see it, right? But we have some things going on internationally, but I was watching live video on my mobile phone in Japan 7 years ago, real time, right? Mm-hmm. And I think there's a number of things. I think one thing, right, is the fact that, you know, we have a challenge with our country, right? I mean, our country's huge, right?
Yes.
In terms of geography, it's very big, right? Where in Japan, if I service, you know, two or three cities, right, I've covered, you know, the majority of the population. So that's one thing. I think the second thing is that you've got a different approach to how the companies here have done versus the companies in Japan, as an example. But that's not the case in every country, right? So in China, well, it's been, you know, well, it's very good in certain popular places, right? Mm-hmm. It's not very good because it's, again, they suffer the same problem. They have a very large population that's spread out all over the place. So there's a number of things. I think one thing is just overall geography in terms of how they approach things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, there is good news on that front as well. The FCC is opening up a number of new bands, the sub 1 gigahertz band, around 900 megahertz. You guys remember cordless phones and baby monitors used to be in that band a while back. They've all moved to the DECT band. So basically, the great thing about 900 megahertz is that, and the bands below it, I don't know if you guys have ever heard about anything called TV white spaces. Basically, when they were broadcasting analog television, they spaced out the channels, right? Channel 2, channel 3, channel 4, channel 5. They spaced it out enough so that there was a bunch of space between each of the channels. And they had to do that to make sure that there was absolutely no overlap of one channel to another in any geographic area. Well, because of the move to digital television, the amount of bandwidth in terms of frequency bandwidth that they need to go shoot out a digital television station is much smaller. So what the FCC is doing is they're opening up the white, what they call the white spaces in between those bands. The interesting thing about that is, you know, why were those bands originally chosen? Those bands were originally chosen because they go ridiculously long distances, right, without a lot of degradation of the signal. So, you know, to tackle this geography problem, what you're going to see over the next 5 years is what they call TV white spaces routing technology, which uses those bands to actually shoot multi megabits worth of data to rural areas in the United States, as well as the interesting problem is going to be how you deal with it in much more populous areas in the United States. I think the 900 megahertz band is another band which I think you're going to see. You know, right now your Wi-Fi mainly works in two bands, right? It works in 2.4 gigahertz and 5 gigahertz. 5 gigahertz doesn't go through walls that well. 2.4 goes through walls, but you don't get a lot of relatively a lot of bandwidth from it. 900 megahertz band, when you'll start to see things called tri-band Wi-Fi devices, where they'll, you know, at some point support 900 megahertz and give you higher levels of bandwidth in the home and around the home, comparatively to what you're seeing in 2.4 and 5 at a given distance.
Okay, mm-hmm. That's good. Just maybe from a more you mentioned regulation and such. I know a lot of companies are countries are mandating certain bandwidths. South Korea, I believe they have 100 megabit to the home requirement. I think the FCC is going to go a long way in helping to open some of that up as well. But also done quite a bit in Europe, and there's just a leapfrog effect that happens with any technology. The U.S. tends to jump into things sometimes before it's very mature, build out a huge infrastructure, and as such, there's a lot of legacy lag at times. I think it's just a natural part of the kind of the culture in different parts of the world, where they can wait sometimes a little longer for technologies to emerge and jump into digital over analog, for example.
So. Yeah, in some places, you know, like in Europe, they've actually embraced power line technology as much or more than Wi-Fi technology, simply because of the construction of the buildings there. They tend to be made out of a lot more stone or a lot more, you know, plaster with the chicken wire behind them and stuff like that, so wireless signals don't go through. And so they've, you know, part of the reason that home plug technology has taken off. There's, I think, like 100 million devices have been sold so far. The vast majority of that does go into places like Europe, where they have much smaller geographical boundaries, but the construction makes it so that wireless doesn't work that well.
All right. Well, I'm going to end it there so I can go see the Bat Bridge before the sun goes down. Oh, yeah. But if you liked what you heard, please give a hand for our panelists.
Yeah.